the Capitol this morning, we have drawn the card of being the streaming video on the internet, hence the additional cameras in our room, and we want to welcome all our internet viewers.
You do.
Yeah, we certainly do. We'll start with some possible measure introduction. Mr. Taylor.
Chair and members of the committee, we have LC 2501 before you from the Oregon Advocacy Center. Prohibits discrimination by public bodies against persons with disability. Expands declaration of public policy relating to persons with disabilities. Defines public body. LC 2321 comes to you from the Oregon Association of Realtors. Modifies incidences that are not material to real property transactions and for which failure to disclose does not give rise to cause of action against owner's agents or transferee's agent. Mr. Chairman of the committee, LC 2126 comes to you from I don't know whom, but it has your name typed on the signature line, Mr. Chair. Subordinates all liens, mortgages, judgments, security interests, and encumbrances, regardless of the date of creation, to liens on personal real property created due to cost of remedial action to abate environmental hazard. LC 1699.
That was Representative Walker's bill, which we are introducing as a committee bill.
Okay.
Request.
LC 16. This is a request of a constituent.
Please go forward.
LC 1699, the American Institute of Architects of Oregon, expands class of persons authorized to perform claim of lien for professional services rendered in constructing improvement to land, authorizes land surveyor's lien if survey is used for establishing property boundaries, creates rebuttable presumption that owner requested professional services of architect, surveyor, or engineer.
Members, you'll recall that bill introduction is something that we do as a committee. Your vote in support of a bill that is being introduced as a committee bill does not necessarily indicate your support for the bill if and when the bill actually receives a hearing in committee. That being said, the chair would move the introduction of the bills which Mr. Taylor has identified. Are there any objections? Any comments? Hearing none. Bills set for introduction will be introduced as committee bills. Next is House Bill 2092. I will open the work session on House Bill 2092A. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2092A bill includes with an aggravated murder statute, that's ORS 163095, a person who intentionally kills a victim because the victim was a juror, a witness, or was to be a witness in the delinquency proceedings. This relates back to several court cases. The most recent one is in relationship to Oregon v. Thompson, where the Court of Appeals, in reviewing the statute, interpreted the term criminal proceedings to exclude juvenile proceedings. And that was contrary to approximately 1984 Supreme Court case, in Oregon v. Maney, where the court, looking at the same statute, said that a criminal proceedings included a juvenile proceedings. What has happened in between there is the case of PGE v. Boley, where the Supreme Court has set forth how they will interpret statutes looking at text and context. And in doing so, the Court of Appeals decided, using that framework, that criminal proceedings did not include juvenile proceedings, juvenile delinquency proceedings. And a juvenile delinquency proceedings is equivalent to an adult criminal proceedings. The main difference is the age of the person before the court. This matter would clarify that, this bill would clarify that that the death penalty would apply, aggravated murder statute would apply regardless of whether it was a criminal proceedings or whether it was a juvenile delinquency proceedings. Also, what we did with the amendment to the bill, which narrowed the original bill, is make it clear that it did not matter whether you're a witness who had received a subpoena or whether you're a witness prior to receiving a subpoena. As long as the person who was alleged to have committed the murder knew that you were to be a witness. That was to, once again, clarify an issue that was clarified in Maney, but we were concerned that under PGV Voley could be interpreted differently. You have the dash two amendments before you, which were adopted in subcommittee.
Thank you, counsel. Colleagues, this bill we heard, obviously, in the criminal subcommittee. We had a very good discussion there. There are obviously some people who are very concerned with Oregon's law under aggravated murder, which allows as a penalty for that conviction to be the death penalty. It is not the only penalty associated with an aggravated murder charge or conviction, but it is an option. And there were certain members of the committee who objected to this bill simply, I think, on that grounds. The fundamental argument that was discussed, I think, in committee was the public policy distinction, or whether there was a public policy distinction between someone who currently can be charged with aggravated murder for killing someone in a criminal proceeding and not being able to be charged with aggravated murder for killing someone in a juvenile proceeding, and the lack of any real public policy distinction between those two crimes. So that was the tenor of the debate as it occurred in the civil subcommittee. Are there any comments here in the full that anyone would like to make? Representative Ringo.
Just to explain my analysis of this, I'm going to oppose the bill just because I do not favor the expansion of the Oregon death penalty.
I understand. I appreciate your comment, Representative Ringo. Any other comments? Yes, Representative Lowe.
I think that it's axiomatic that hard cases make bad law, and I applaud any effort to bring consistency to our statutes, and what's sauce for the goose in circuit court ought to be sauce for the gander in juvenile court. So to the extent that this bill brings consistency to witness protections in juvenile court, I think that's just fine. However, and if that were all that this bill did, I could live with it and vote comfortably for it. But the bottom line of this bill is that it would result in an expansion of application of the death penalty to a broader category of people, and that means that dead is dead. More people will die at the hands of the state, and this at a time when the American Bar Association is seeking a moratorium from all states on expanding the death penalty until a broader discussion can be had on the issue, especially in light of DNA evidence and technological developments that are blossoming, because science has expanded its response in criminal cases. And for that reason, I am going to oppose this bill.
Thank you, Representative Lowe. Any other comments by members? Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to remark, for the record, I will be supporting this bill today to get it out of committee. I, too, am not a supporter of the death penalty and will not support the bill on the floor, but will have to get it out of committee today.
Okay. Any other comments? Representative Bowman?
I just want to reiterate for the record, I appreciate the tenor of the conversation we've had as a committee. It's been a real change of pace to be able to have a conversation about such an important issue in a manner that's been very respectful of all views. And so just for the record, I wanted to say that. But having said that, I will still not be supporting this piece of legislation because, unfortunately, after you kill somebody and the DNA evidence proves that they were not the correct person, that person will still be a dead individual. And until we are absolutely certain as states that we have the right person that we're putting to death, I just can't in good conscience support this. So I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, and will not be supporting your bill.
Thank you, Representative Bowman. I understand. I guess I would say to the committee and to those in attendance somewhat what I said yesterday in the civil or in the criminal subcommittee, that I fully understand and can appreciate and can respect people's views with regard to the death penalty and how that might factor into their view about this particular bill. I do believe, however, that we are sort of seeing things in that discussion sort of backwards through the looking glass on this issue. I can agree with Representative Bowman wholeheartedly and would hope that we will see and actually be able to act on legislation involving DNA evidence that will be beneficial to making sure that we never, never, as the state,
put the wrong person to death. But I would say that I don't believe that the concerns about the death penalty in this instance with respect to this bill are such that it warrants its absolute opposition. Aggravated murder is the charge. It is only one possible result from an aggravated murder charge, and I understand how that can be viewed as an expansion. But I also think that the lack of a compelling public policy reason to treat someone who kills a witness in a proceeding differently warrants us making this consistent change, a change that was, in fact, the law of the land in Oregon under Oregon versus Manning, and then changed as a result of PGE versus Boley in the more recent case of Oregon versus Thompson, which has put us in the situation that we're in now. So with that, I do respect everyone's views with respect to this bill, but I do think it's something that we ought to fix within the system, and so we will move forward, I believe. Any other comments from any members of the committee? Representative Walker.
Chair, I would just like to say that whenever I look at any type of expansion of criminal statute, that I like to look at the idea of is it a deterrent? Is this going to improve our system? I particularly don't think this will. I don't think that's going to happen. I was not on the criminal side to hear the testimony, but that is my personal conviction. However, I will vote to put it to the floor so the full body can consider it.
Thank you, Representative Walker. I appreciate your comments.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Walker, the other Representative Walker.
Yeah, that's why I was going to mention to you, we are now on the Internet, and if you could identify us by first name as well, so those out there in computer land know which Representative Walker is speaking.
I will try as much as I can. To
I know.
I cannot promise you I always will, but I will try as much as I can.
All right.
I know she will. That's right.
And
you're welcome to shout out.
Okay. And I did make my comments yesterday in criminal sub,
right.
So I will remain silent today.
Thank you, Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a brief comment. My personal view is that our principles of criminal justice should be based upon reformation, and I think that that is a fundamental policy choice for me. You can't reform someone after they've been executed. They will lose all that opportunity, and it's for those reasons I'll vote against a referral of this with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Anyone else? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want you to know that I support your comments related to this today. There is certainly no public policy difference in what we're doing today versus what is already in statute. I do want to mention again that I think the people in the state have already had the debate about the death penalty, and I do want to say that I appreciate the tenor of our conversation here today as well. But in light of this and the lack of a real difference in this issue from a public policy standpoint, I do wholeheartedly support the passing of this.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. With that, then, I would ask that the clerk, well, I guess we need a motion. Have I moved it or just opened the hearing? I don't think I have moved it, have I? With that, the chair would move House Bill 2092 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
No.
Representative Backman?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
No.
Representative Cheverly?
Yes.
Representative Ringo?
No.
Representative?
Yes.
Representative Vicki Walker?
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Representative Williams.
Votes aye. House Bill 2092 will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the carrier. I need to excuse Representative Wilson and Representative Shetterly, who have another meeting that they have to attend. Committee, I believe that we'll go just probably less than an hour.
Mr. Chairman, we'd like to serve notice of a possible minority report.
Pardon?
Well,
I concur.
Okay. Appreciate you serving notice, and Representative Bowman has joined Representative Lowe in a possible minority report on House Bill 2092. We'll need to work with Mr. Taylor on that.
We do know about that.
So it's safe to say this won't go into consent now. It's safe to say. House Bill, we'll now move to House Bill 2099.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2099 comes to you at the request of the Governor John Kitzhafer. This measure allows law enforcement to extradite to another state an individual has broken the terms of the individual security release, probation, parole, or other release agreement in the other state without the requirement of a warrant accompanying hearing. If the individual has signed a prior waiver extradition as a condition of release in the other state, and a law enforcement agency holding the individual has received an authenticated copy of the prior waiver. As you may remember from the testimony from Mr. Brown, we have similar provisions, and they're honored in other states. The problem is that there's an interpretation going back to 1952 that states that we probably, from the Attorney General's office, need to have a proceedings before a judge.
Who was assigned as a carrier on this?
I was, Mr. Chair.
Oh, thank you. Representative Ackerman, would you like to address the bill?
Yes, just briefly, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Under current law, as I understand it, a person who is here from a sister state who is wanted in that sister state because of a parole or probation violation can have an extradition hearing in our local courts. The hearing, however, is only limited to the identification of the subject as the one being wanted by the demanding state. And once that is established, the demanding state is given a period of time to come to Oregon and return the defendant to the demanding state. One option which is available in the process is for the defendant to waive extradition, and that typically happens in, I would say, most overwhelming percentage of the cases, and the extradition process is thereby expedited. The current law, however, says that that waiver must only occur before a judge, and in many instances, probationers or parolees, having been given the right to travel and perhaps come to Oregon, sign waivers of extradition in the demanding state. And the purpose of this law is to use those waivers as waivers in the Oregon courts so that the extradition process can be expedited. What would happen and how this bill would be implemented is that the arresting agency here would receive an authenticated copy of the defendant's waiver from the sister state, make the appropriate identification of the subject, and the defendant then would be held for a period of time until a demanding state could come up here and take the defendant back to the demanding state. So basically what this does is allows our system to recognize waivers of extradition which were not signed before a judge in this court but were signed in a sister state. It seems to streamline the process, and I see no rights which would be violated by the defendant under these circumstances, particularly since the scope of an extradition hearing is very narrow.
Any questions for either counsel or for Representative Ackerman on the bill? Representative Ackerman, it passed out of the sub with the unanimous vote, is that correct?
I think it was Representative Wilson voted no.
Oh, Representative Wilson voted no on this issue. Okay, good. Thank you. Are there any other questions of the committee?
Yes, I do have some questions.
Feel free, Representative Lowe.
And I don't mind who answers this, whether it's a good representative from Ashland or the... Is that right?
She's from Eugene, I think.
Eugene, sorry. From Eugene. Or the one from Tiger, but or anybody else, but it's my understanding that the criminal defense lawyers had opposition to this because the waiver may not be voluntary since it's a condition of leaving custody. There's no assurance of voluntariness, and the waiver may be made, I guess I've missed the second point, but the first one is the one that impressed me the most, and so I thought that I would... although I voted to bring this out of committee to the full, I wondered if there could be further discussion on that issue.
I think I could maybe address part of the question, Representative Lowe. The people to which this applies are primarily persons on parole or on probation, so they have not signed anything as a condition of their release. They have signed a waiver in their states as a condition to travel to another state. And you have to keep in mind, these people are still under court supervision, either by parole or by probation status, and to some extent their rights are limited because of that. But I don't see anything that would challenge the voluntariness of the waiver under those circumstances, because these people are still under the jurisdiction of the court. If their rights were fundamentally impaired by this procedure, they do have the right to petition the court for writ of habeas corpus, and on the constitutional grounds would be able to have that issue litigated in our courts. So I believe that their rights are protected either by the system or by the remedies which they have under current law.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman. Any other comments? Okay. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I move House Bill 2099 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves House Bill 2099 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Would you call the roll? I guess comments, I guess, to her motion. Are there any discussion? Okay, go ahead and call the roll, please.
Ackerman?
Yes.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Lowe?
Yes.
Greenbaum?
Aye.
Carol Walker?
Yes.
Vicki Walker?
Yes.
Wilson?
Excused.
Bowman?
Yes.
Vice Chair Speaker?
Yes.
Chair Williams?
Both aye. House Bill 2099 moves to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Representative Ackerman, would you be willing to carry this on the floor?
Certainly. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Okay, we will now move on to House Bill 2100. Representative Walker, you were the carrier on the bill. Would you like to speak to the bill or have counsel address it?
I can do that, Mr. Chair. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank
Representative
you.
Vicki Walker speaking to the bill. This bill came out of our criminal sub on a unanimous decision, though Representative Shetterly was excused. The bill allows the Department of Corrections or the county sheriff to release an inmate whose sentence ends on a weekend or a holiday 2 or even 3 days before the release date, so that the inmate's actual release is not on a weekend or holiday. In plain English, what that means is that currently the Department of Corrections is allowed to release an inmate 1 day prior to the release date if it falls on a weekend or holiday, which means they get out on a Friday. Inmates who travel to back to their home county, which is where they are released to, if they're released in way out in southeastern Oregon or in southern Oregon, the bus connections may be difficult to make, which puts them in past the time where they can check in with local officials, which leaves them open to mischief or not able to get the services they need. So the Department of Corrections would like limited authority to be able to release an inmate 2 days early. Did we say 2 or 3?
2 or 3.
2 or 3 days early to facilitate those transitions. It would be very, very limited. We only had we had two people testify, Scott Taylor from the Oregon Department of Corrections, and he discussed this issue with us. And then Dale Pinn from the Oregon District Attorneys Association came in support. There was no one to testify in opposition. And I believe that we should pass this bill to the full committee. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Representative Vicki Walker. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add for the record that this bill requires a two-third vote of both houses in order to pass.
And I should make, a clarification. I think the committee members understand that, but for the record and for those who are perhaps tuning in, This would require or allow a very small amount of discretion to the Department of Corrections to release early, including ballot measure 11 related offenses. And as you'll recall, measure 10, at the same time ballot measure 11 was passed, required that any changes in an initiative, a people's initiative sponsored mandatory sentence, required a two-thirds vote of the legislature in order to reduce it. So even though we're talking just about a couple of days potentially that someone's sentence might be reduced, it still requires a two-thirds vote constitutionally for the change to be made. Obviously, the people who would be typically most concerned about an issue like this would be the District Attorneys Association. And as you heard from Representative Vicki Walker, the District's Attorneys Association testified through their chairperson, Dale Penn. And in fact, in your packet, you should find a letter from Dale Penn on HB 2100, where he indicates that the Oregon Law Enforcement Committee, comprised of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon State Chiefs of Police, and the Oregon State Police, have no objection to this bill, and including the District Attorneys Association as well. And obviously, the point is to get people released at a time when they're least likely to reconnect with people who are going to get them back into some bad habits. So it's a very practical transition, reentry change in the system. So with that, are there any other questions to Representative Vicki Walker as the carrier of the bill or anyone else on the committee? Okay, hearing none, the chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vicki Walker.
I'll make a motion that we do pass HB 2100 to the floor.
Representative Walker has moved House Bill 2100 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Backerman?
Aye.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Ringel?
Excused.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Vicki Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bowman?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Votes aye. House Bill 2100 will move to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Representative Walker, would you like to be the carrier?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I understand that it cannot go on the consent calendar because one member was excused when we voted on it. Is that correct?
You know, I have to look at that rule. We'll eventually find some bill that we're comfortable with putting on a consent calendar. I'm not comfortable putting this one on our consent calendar
because
of the two-thirds majority and the Measure 10 / Measure 11 component.
I agree.
I think this is going to need to be fully explained to the members so they understand the importance of the majority that we need to vote for this
All right.
Bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to carry that, and I would request that committee counsel be present on this bill because I suspect there will be questions.
Well, and I believe that the members of the committee will be pleased to support you in testimony on this bill on the floor in any way they can, Representative Vicki Walker.
Absolutely.
Bill, having received the necessary vote, is passed to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, Representative Vicki Walker to carry. House Bill 2333. Who's the carrier on that one?
Mr. Chair, I am.
Representative Backlund, would you like to do it or would you like counsel to do it?
Council can proceed initially, and I'll be happy to pick up the ball.
Okay, great. Thank you. Council?
Thank you, Chair. It requires that the court, if Department of Revenue is unable to collect from the account in 1 year after assigning to it, private collection agency.
Thank you, Representative Cheryl Walker. This bill would align the Judicial Department with the other, or with the executive branches, legislation was passed, I believe it was last session, that made the same requirements for the executive branch, and there was a problem with the relating clause, and that was why the judicial department was not included.
Thank you, counsel.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would add very little to that. I would have you note that this passed out of our sub civil sub unanimously with a 5-0 vote. We had a considerable amount of discussion, actually, in terms of the definition of the word liquidated. And I feel that this is kind of a, to my mind, a housekeeping sort of a thing, a sort of a bill, and I would recommend that we pass it and move it on to the floor.
Okay. Do I take that as a motion, Representative Backlund?
I'd be happy to make a motion. Mr. Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 2333 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Backlund has moved House Bill 2333 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Representative Bowman.
Mr. Chair, is the appropriate motion that this bill go to Ways and Means rather than to the floor?
Do you have a fiscal impact statement?
Yes,
in front
Mr.
of you?
Chair, I do.
Can you pass it over to me? I don't seem to have one. Well, colleagues, the fiscal impact statement would reflect that it has a total fiscal impact on the expenditure side of $779,706. However, I think the effect on the revenue side, which is additional fine collections in the amount of $5,300,000, counterbalances that fiscal impact by a wide margin. So as I read this, I think we're adding to the budget as opposed to taking away from it.
If I might, Mr.
Please,
Chair.
Please, Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, though, since this has not been considered in the current budget that we're operating and attempting to balance, the taking a significant chunk of money like this and assuming that we will make it up because we will be able to do this collection, I'm troubled by. We're in such a tight budget, I can't imagine sending something to the floor that hasn't gone through the Ways and Means process to determine whether or not we can afford these efficiencies under the current budget system.
Let me, I guess I'd like to bring some invited testimony up during our work session here. Kingsley, can you come forward and maybe address this issue?
Thank you. For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator, Chair Williams and Representative Bowman and committee. There, the fiscal impact that is noted is related to a policy package in the Chief Justice's budget for collections personnel in Multnomah County on a limited duration basis. It's approximately 10 FTE. So Representative Bowman is correct in order to meet the fiscal, in order to have the people to bring in the revenue, we would need to have the appropriation in our current 0103 budget.
Was it your understanding that this bill would be referred then to Ways and Means?
Chair Williams, it was my initial impression that's where it would need to go at
okay.
some point in the process.
Okay. Well, we can accommodate your initial impression.
I just want it to come out of there.
As do we.
Chair Williams, should I rephrase the motion?
Would you withdraw your motion and make a new one, Representative Backlund?
Indeed. I move House Bill 2333 with a due pass recommendation to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you. Representative Backlund has made a motion to send House Bill 2333 to the Ways and Means Committee, subsequent referral with a due pass recommendation. Any comments, discussion? Any objection from any of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make one comment. I'd like to thank Representative Bowman for bringing that to my attention. It's an oversight on my part, and I apologize.
No problem. Thank you. It just scared me.
It's a good catch. None of us want to be in trouble with the co-chair of the Ways and Means Committee from our side, so I appreciate Representative Bowman catching that. Without objection, then, this committee will refer House Bill 2333 to the Ways and Means Committee with a do-pass recommendation. Thanks, Joanne. Our next bill is House Bill 2334. The carrier on that, Council?
I believe that's me.
Representative Lowe, would you like Council to address the bill, or would you like to go first?
I think that it would be appropriate for Council to address this bill. It's fairly straightforward, and she can articulate it far more succinctly than I can.
Council?
Thank you, Chair Williams and Representative Lowe, although I'm not sure that's true. Members of the committee, what 2334 does is establish a court productivity and access improvement revolving account. That account, in plain English, would be an account that would be designed for the Judicial Department to loan or grant or fund different programs within the local court system to work on productivity and efficiency type programs and also public access programs. The money from that account would come first from some seed money. It would also come from waived jury payments, interest earnings on any account balances, and savings realized from the implementation of the productivity projects. this account would be similar to an account the executive branch has under ORS 182-365-385, which I believe it was testified to at the subcommittee that has been in place for over 10 years. And this bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means and was passed unanimously out of the sub. I think that pretty much covers everything. The one amendment that we had in committee, subcommittee, was that the findings at the top of the bill, which were mirrored the findings in the executive branch's legislation, were removed.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Council. I think that pretty much outlines it, but in terms of policy issues, this is a very good idea. Oftentimes, people come up with fabulous suggestions on how to improve access to our courts or to make our courts more user-friendly for the citizenry or the people that use them. For example, somebody came up with a brilliant idea of having family courts in communities or family and drug courts in the communities, but it took 8 years to implement that because of a variety of reasons, money being among them. This would speed up implementation of bright ideas and add to the local character of our courts. We took a tour of Marion County's court house and noted that they had a reception area in which people had assistance in self-help litigation. That reception area included a small, friendly place for children to sit and watch Walt Disney videos or Winnie the Pooh videos and play with puzzles and so forth while their parents work on dealing with their legal problems with a little assistance from a clerk there. This sort of fund would enable other courthouses to put something like that in there or to implement other ideas that will result in a savings to the taxpayers by making our courts a little bit more efficient. So the only person that had any problem with the bill at all was Representative Shetterly, and his was a housekeeping suggestion to the original draft of House Bill 2334, in that he asked that the warm and fuzzy language, outlining the reasons for this bill be removed from the bill, and I think that that was more of a style recommendation than anything else. It passed enthusiastically from our subcommittee, and I, Mr. Chairman, recommend passage to Ways and Means with a due pass.
Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Chair, I have just a few questions. I'm just trying to understand what would be a documented budget saving resulting from increased efficiency. I can think of a lot of court efficiencies that might fall within that definition. I'm having trouble and ask the question as to how those efficiencies are converted into cash and deposited into this account. Let me give you an example. I have a bill pending to increase the court annex arbitration limits from $25,000 to $50,000, meaning that a substantial portion of the court's civil caseload would be diverted into court annex arbitration in the first instance. These programs are 90% effective. One could certainly see that this results in a tremendous savings of judicial costs, not only for running the court system, but to paying judges' salaries and staff salaries. Now, suppose that this results in a savings of documented savings of $750,000 in a particular county. What happens? Does that money go into this account? Where does it come from, and who makes these decisions? I just don't know how the Act works.
Representative Lowe, do you have any response to Representative Ackerman?
Thank you. Only this response. Oftentimes, the efficiencies suggested, if they are tried, it would be difficult to find an objective criteria upon which to put a number to the actual amount of savings, and I agree with you on that. And so sometimes the efficiencies will be more subjective than objective. And to the extent that that is not clear, I would defer the question to counsel and ask for a response.
And I actually, this question was actually raised in the subcommittee and was dealt with to a certain extent by, I believe it was Ms. about the issue of, for example, some of the efficiency would come in a staff person's time would free up, and there was the intention that obviously that staff person would be assigned to other work, and they're not really talking about that kind of money. I think they're talking more about situations where, for example, they use less paper. And so that money, rather than ordering that paper, that gets credited to the account. But if the chair is interested, perhaps the sponsors of the bill would want to talk to that.
Kingsley, would you like to come forward and address that question?
Thank you. For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. Excuse me one second. Chair Williams and Representative Backlund, I understand the concerns in that particular situation where it would be, Representative Ackerman too, a legislative mandate, that would be something that wouldn't be a savings that the department was doing as an efficiency or as a particular pilot project. So in that sense, that would not, if there were tangible savings from that, that would not be something that would fall under this. It was more in the line with what Representative Lowe brought up as suggestions. There's a 10-year history in the exec department. They prepare a report. They have a committee. It goes through. It's documented. Then when they go through their budget cycle, it's reviewed what's been accrued to it. And so there are a number of what I would feel are checks and balances in that sort of system. But it is aimed at looking at kind of what you're doing every day and are there better ways that are not maybe apparent and having a tangible, if you're saving a judge or a staff, you're not necessarily, as Representative Lowe mentioned, saving a person that goes away. It's often in these times that they're just picking up some other part of the pending caseload.
Representative Rigo.
I did not oppose this bill in subcommittee, but I did express concerns about it, and it's interesting that Representative Ackerman raised some of the same concerns. I guess the fiscal conservative in me is cautious about creating a fund that where there's a lot of discretion, and I don't know that's a good practice to have in government. Obviously, we want to give some discretion, but we all know that there is a tendency to spend the money you have and to find a program that's useful. And that was a question I had asked in our subcommittee. How do you know what savings accrue from this program? Who's going to make the decision as to how those savings are going to be allocated? I still don't know the answer to that. And I just raised that I guess the other thought that I expressed during the subcommittee was a concern that we need some sort of program like this to encourage government efficiency.
Right.
We should encourage our branches of government to look to be as efficient as possible without some sort of incentive program. And so in some ways I don't understand the philosophy behind this. If we need more resources in our court system, then let's just give them to them, rather than create some sort of discretionary fund and an ambiguous system of money saved. Just the other couple points further. I asked during the subcommittee how much money is raised from the jury per diem and mileage expenses that would be waived. The answer to that was about $344,000. The other question I raised in subcommittee was how much money did they expect to ask from Ways and Means? And I know that maybe that's not decided yet, but the answer there was somewhere between $100,000 and $500,000. So we're talking about substantial sums for a discretionary program that, at least to me, is pretty ambiguous in nature. And I just wanted to express those concerns to this committee.
I appreciate that, Representative Ringo. I, in looking at this, have had some of the similar feelings that you've had on this issue. I guess there are two things that sort of mitigate against some of my concerns. One is that, and maybe three, I guess, three points I'd like to make. One is that there has been a 10-year track record with a similar program in the executive department, which I think generally, if you consider sort of who's been running the executive and who's been running the legislative branch over the last 10 years, if this was a problem of abuse or if there had been abuse, I think that's something that we would have surely dealt with legislatively. Second, you know, we oftentimes talk about the need or the desire that government be entrepreneurial. We want government to be like, you know, that only run government like a business, and we say that, but then we're always, it seems to me, unwilling to give them the flexibility that business needs to sometimes implement those entrepreneurial ideas. So we lock them in a cycle where they come to us every 2 years where we appropriate money for a program, and then if somebody has a good idea, they're locked in from not being able to implement that good idea, from not being able to implement that change until they come back to the legislature 2 years later and have to work that way through the process during the pressure cooker of the legislative session when they're being asked to make choices among a number of excellent ideas and excellent programs, including the salaries that they're going to pay their judges, their court staff, the number of judges they're going to have. And so a lot of those good ideas fall down sort of the tubes in that process as other priorities take place. And then the third part that I guess gives me some comfort level with this bill is if you look in subsection 5 of section 2 of the bill, it talks about the fact and requires the department in preparing the budget for the following biennium in which they credit any amount to the court productivity and access improvement revolving account, that they shall identify any reduction or offset in department expenses resulting from the improved efficiency. The department shall include in the budget a report of the programs or projects funded from the account. And so there is a control mechanism for the legislature at the end of the biennium to say, did you use this? what did you improve on and not spend money on, what that amount was, and what did you spend it on? What was your so-called improvement or enhancement that you directed those funds to? So every 2 years, the legislature has the opportunity to review that and to determine whether in our best interest is the keepers of the Treasury on this point, whether or not we agreed with their use of this account. So there is an oversight mechanism, I guess, that mitigates my concerns about the discretionary nature of the funds. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually come from this from a different view. I guess my concern is we pay jurors such little money. I mean, you know, jury duty is a responsibility of citizenship. And we are in a cycle where people will do anything and tell any tale to try not to do their civic duty to serve on juries. I guess I'm concerned when we create a fund where we encourage people to not take the measly amount of money we offer, and then we say, and we're going to figure out what to do with that measly amount of money as a collective, as the government. I have a philosophical problem with that. You know, I think if in fact we are going to ask people who don't need the per diem to give that money back, I would really like to see a system whereby we paid people who needed real money a real living wage to serve on our juries. And so if we're funding this by the money that we are supposed to be paying citizens to participate in our civil process, I guess I just have a real fundamental problem with that. I know they don't, you know, some people don't get paid from their jobs when they serve on jury duty. And those people are people that we should be supporting. I think government needs to figure out how to do the efficiencies and how to be creative and how to think like a business, but not at the expense of the poorest people in our community who we have asked to do one of the greatest services that they could do, which is to listen impartially and make decisions about people's lives. So other than that, that's my philosophical problem. I have exact problems with the legislation. The fact that we don't have a fiscal, so we as a committee do not know how much money is being asked for from the Ways and Means Committee bothers me. The fact that there's a blank space that says appropriate blank in this bill with no fiscal documentation that justifies the amount of money that's being asked for is also a problem for me. And so I've heard nothing today that gives me any reason to be confident that the safeguards that are placed in this bill are sufficient so that this will act the way we intend this bill to act.
Okay, thank you, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm not convinced that my questions were answered, but let me try again with respect to the witness. Granted that state-mandated efficiencies may not accrue under this fund, however, the bill doesn't say that. But let me pose another hypothetical of a non-mandated efficiency. In our court systems, in many counties now, we are mediating most of our small claims cases through voluntary mediators. That program is also successful. It saves a tremendous amount of judicial time, a tremendous amount. Are you saying that a monetary, and this could be quantified, are you saying then that the local court system, having realized that efficiency, those efficiency dollars would be subjected to coming within the fund created by this bill? And wouldn't that short the resources of our local courts? And I'd like to ask that question first before we move on, because I can see lots of efficiencies that the courts are engaging in on their own initiative, but I fear that they're going to lose them.
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman. The particular account that mediators are paid out of now is the person.
Well, these are voluntary mediations.
Right, so they're not paid by anyone.
That's correct.
Saying if it was saving it.
We're using voluntary unpaid mediators in small claims cases to save judicial time.
Correct. And so they're not paid now. If they went to paid, if I was doing the analogy, if they were paid and they went to unpaid, would that be something that accrued to the account? And I was saying it wouldn't because they were right now paid by the parties in mediation for any fees. So I don't see those as falling in. I'm open to working on language that would make the committee more comfortable that in defining, I can look at what exec has and some OARs and defining what more clearly falls within the parameters on it. For the department, the emphasis was not so much on the efficiency end. I mean, that was something that mirrored exec and seemed to be working well and seemed to have equal application to the courts. But for the Chief Justice, the interest was really on the ability to encourage local projects, you know, have the seed money to do the grants, to do the reality testing in the court, so to speak, of good ideas that improved access and improve the quality of services. And for us, that was the major interest in the bill, though people always say, how are you going to fund it? And that's where some of the funding ideas came in.
I have a couple of follow-up questions because I still have this feeling that the judicial department under this bill would have the authority to identify efficiencies in our local courts and appropriate that back into this fund and thereby cut our court system off of funds, our local court systems off of funds which they sorely need. I do not see any anything in this bill that tells us what standards would be employed to appropriate these efficiencies and under what means they would be. And I'm really concerned about the cost shifting in this situation. If our local court systems have efficiencies, that usually would manifest itself in some cash carryover at the end of the year, which would be a part of our general fund. I see this bill as a means to appropriate those monies from the general fund into this particular account, and I think for those reasons it has some fiscal deficiencies. I might ask just a question of inquiry on the waived jury fees and per diem expenses. Are those now paid by the county or paid by the state?
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, they're in the circuit courts, they are paid by the state for both trial jurors and grand jurors.
Okay.
And it is a judicial department statewide account.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Actually, Representative Krieger was next, and then Representative Wilk.
Kingsley, you're talking about an unknown number of dollars that's discretionary, which seems to be pretty large, but we don't know how big. Are there other type discretionary accounts within state budgets of all these other agencies, similar to this size?
Chair Williams, Representative Krieger, I'm not sure I understand exactly the question. The blank in the bill is what I would call customary. You can suggest the amount, but often it's customary if it's going to Ways and Means that they determine anything from zero to something that they're willing to risk on it or. So it wasn't intended as anything other than going with the custom. My understanding is when in 1989 when the executive branch set up their account that they did have seed money. It came from, it was a general fund appropriation. What it was under the lid of what they were going to get that biennium anyway, which might be how it would operate down in Ways and Means. If they wanted to appropriate some general fund, they might say, we were going to give you this much anyway. Maybe we'll just unfetter some of it and let you have it in this, but you're not getting in addition to what we were going to appropriate you. They did a little bit of that last biennium with some positions. They gave it centrally. Said, do your study, determine where they should go, come back and report to us. So, and I don't know a lot about other agencies' discretionary accounts, how that works.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is not my bill. I don't have any pride of authorship over it, and I was merely assigned to carry it from committee. I have found our discussion to be fruitful and provocative. But I would like to ask you a question, Ms. Clerk, if I may, about what happens to the money which a juror refuses because he is receiving compensation already from his employer and doesn't need it or require it or indeed may be prohibited from accepting it, as in the case of a state employee assigned to jury duty, cannot accept additional compensation from the state because they're already receiving a salary. So when these travel fees or whatever, these fees are waived, witness fees, jury per diem fees are waived, what happens to that sum, $344,000, statewide? What happens to that money now?
Chair Williams, Representative Lowe, and I may have to ask Susan to come up on part of it. I know from the Judicial Department, because our employees, you just don't accept it, and so it just doesn't get paid out. The provisions last session that changed before that, there was no requirement if you were already getting paid a wage that you had to not accept your juror fee. So that's a change, and it goes in effect July 1st of this upcoming biennium as well. And I'm sorry, Representative Bowman isn't still here. The juror fees go up to minimum wage, daily wage, not to exceed $50 a day for the third day of service. So it's still $10 a day for the first 2 days of service, but if you're on 3 days and longer, then you're daily per diem goes up to $50, and the mileage is also was also increased last session to go into effect July 1st of this year. So there is some thing going. But the waivers now, my understanding is it goes back to the general fund. One of the things that comes up is because when you're paid your $10, there's a 1099 done, so it's also through government accounting reported as taxable income. So a lot of people just want to, and they would like to donate. They say, I don't need the $10. I'd like to donate to a local charity or whatever, but they still have to go through the tax sort of thing. They have to accept it and then donate it. And this kind of gave away for an access fund that would be aimed at that access in the courts to allow them to donate to that in lieu of accepting it and donating it out. But there's no pressure for them to do that. I should ask, or just turn to see if Susan has more information about where waived fees go now so that I can give you a correct answer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Klosterman, Finance Director with the State Court Administrator's Office, and currently the waived fees do stay with the general fund. If they aren't used for mandated payments, they would revert to the general fund. But Kingsley is correct, effective July 1, 2001, those monies would stay with the Judicial Department to be used for programs designated by the Chief Justice, and that was the new law passed last session.
Thank you, Susan. Representative Ackerman.
I just have one concluding remark, which I think may point out another deficiency in the bill. You request that the fund be partially funded by jury fees, which are waived. Well, maybe I can withdraw this. You're not saying witness fees. You're just saying jury fees. Is that correct?
Chair Williams, okay. Representative Ackerman, yes.
I think so. Okay, then I'll withdraw my remarks. Thank you,
Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you. The good representative from Eugene just handed me the ORS. The 1999, which we enacted last session, and I would like to read to the committee and for the record what is to go in effect July 1st at page 103 of volume 1 under ORS 10.075 in the note. Each circuit court shall offer each juror the opportunity to waive receipt of the per diem and mileage expenses otherwise payable to the juror for the purpose of funding Judicial Department programs and activities identified by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. All amounts waived by a juror under the provisions of this subsection are continuously appropriated to the Judicial Department programs and activities that are identified by the Chief Justice for receipt of waived amounts and may be used only for the purposes of those programs and activities. This section does not apply to mileage and other expenses of jurors reimbursed by a county as provided in ORS 10.061 sub 4. So you're going to get the money anyway.
Under the law, yes, this was put into this bill just so there was one account. It was more a management tool when that was added to this bill for that, and the chief is using it for access benefit for the court and the public.
Thank you, committee. I think we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2334 at this time.
I would ask Kingsley if you'd work with the
members that raise questions to try to respond to those as you can, and then we'll determine whether or not the bill moves forward at this point. I'll open the work session on House Bill 2338. The carrier for this bill is Representative Cheddarly, who is excused from the meeting this morning. So I'd ask counsel to address the bill if they could.
Thank you, Chair Williams. Members of the committee, House Bill 2338 is a technical change and that addresses two problems identified by the Judicial Department. The first is that the Judicial Department has a mediation type program for appellate cases. And when a case goes into that program, at that time the appeal is held in abeyance for 120 days. Separate from that, when a case begins to go through the appeal process, a transcript is ordered, and court reporters work on that transcript. When they do that, they turn it in, certifying that it is a transcript of the proceedings, and the parties involved have, under current law, have 15 days to make a motion to correct that transcript if they find problems with that transcript. One of the points that Mr. Nass from the Judicial Department pointed out was that if a party's involved in mediation and it looks like things are going to work out, they don't want to spend the time and effort to try to correct the transcript. Plus, a lot of times that transcript will go ahead and be being produced during that 120-day period, and it's unclear right now in present law whether or not that motion needs to be filed within those 15 days. It appears that it does, and so lots of motions to correct transcripts that end up being moot are filed. In addition, another problem is that oftentimes, as Representative Vicki Walker probably can attest to, different court reporters work on different days or different parts of a proceeding, so they'll turn in their transcripts on different days. And right now, the present law is somewhat ambiguous. Does a party, if one part of the transcript comes in today, do they have 15 days from today for that part? And then if another part comes in tomorrow, do they have 15 days from that? So what this does is just kind of make it all clear what's going to happen. And one of the things that it does is that motions to correct transcripts are due, I believe it's 15 days after the repeal is reactivated or after the abatement period ends, and then also 15 days after the final portion of the transcript has been submitted. And that's the change that's made.
Good. Thank you. Any questions for counsel about this change? Representative Walker, Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did anyone from the Court Reporters Association testify on behalf of this bill?
No. Nobody appeared, and I quite frankly, I didn't get a hold of anyone from them, and so that was an oversight on my part.
Mr. Nance, would you be willing to come up for just a second so I could ask you a question? Have you received any feedback or comment about this bill from the appellate law section of the state bar?
For the record, my name is Jim Nance, legal counsel for the appellate courts. Chairman Williams, I am a member of the appellate practice section of the bar. We ran by them our bills, and I did not receive any negative feedback from anyone there.
Okay. I mean, as I read this, Mr. Nance, it seemed like a very sort of technical change that cleared up some deadlines and would cause people to not have to waste time doing things while they were in your appellate process or your mediation process that might be sort of futile and a waste of time and resources and the court's resources in dealing with the motions to correct the transcript. So it seemed completely reasonable to me. Can't imagine any opposition, and we've certainly posted this and given everybody their opportunity to come in and say something if they had an opinion about it. Any other comments from members of the committee? Yes, please, Representative Ringo.
Well, I just completely agree with you. This seems a housekeeping matter that ought to be put on the consent calendar.
Kingsley Click from the court administrator's office is flagging me, so if she'll come forward, you're getting a lot of overtime in today, Ms. Kingsley. We appreciate it.
Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. Yes, but since it looks like it's going out, maybe I should keep my mouth shut. snatch a victory from the...
That was one of the rules that, you know, I learned early as a lawyer, is that if the judge was agreeing with you, you should talk less.
Right. Exactly. And when I raised my hand before, I heard that it was not... I was just going to mention, I met with Dave Barrows yesterday, who represents the Court Reporters Association, and they were fine with the bill. The one thing they asked was just that we work on an internal procedure to make sure that the court reporter was notified when it came out of appellate mediation, so they would know if they did not have the transcript ready that they should prepare it, because this is if it came out and was not resolved and was going to go forward with court appeals, so that they could make sure they had time to prepare the transcript before oral arguments scheduled and briefs were due.
Does that satisfy you, Representative Walker?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chair, because I didn't get a chance to read these last night, and I was reviewing it, and that would have been my question, too. We're always very worried about timelines and making sure we comply with that. So thank you for coming forward and clarifying that for me.
Thank you both. The Chair would entertain a motion on House Bill 2338.
Yes, Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move House Bill 2338 to the floor with a Duke House recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves House Bill 2338 to the floor with a Duke House recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Now, Representative Bowman, do you want to make a motion about the consent calendar?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House Bill 2338 be placed on the consent calendar and at the House floor.
This is our first experience testing out the consent calendar motion. Representative has moved that House Bill 2338 be placed on the consent calendar. Placement on the consent calendar means that it will stay on the consent calendar unless someone objects to its placement on that calendar, at which point it will require that it be that a carrier be assigned. So it's required that I assign a backup carrier. So first, let me find out if there are any objections to the placement of the motion on the bill on the consent calendar. Any objections? Bill will be placed on the consent calendar. Representative Cheryl Walker, would you be willing to carry this bill as the backup carrier in case someone objects?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair,
yes,
for the record. I'd like to remind the chair that it takes actually four people to object to an item being on a consent calendar, and they have
four members. General body, right?
Yeah, total.
Right. Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other comments? Okay, committee, we are adjourned for the day. Thank you. Quick announcement. You'll recall that next Wednesday we're taking... Oh, yes, Representative Ringo.
I'm sorry. I was wondering if you could just reopen so that I can vote. I stepped out briefly and missed a couple votes.
Do you know which ones you missed, Representative Ringo?
2100. Did you also pass the one on the delinquent court accounts?
We did not move that bill.
Okay, the 2100
Did we move that bill?
It was moved to Ways and Means.
I see. 2100 relating to corrections.
Okay. Representative Ringel would seek unanimous consent to reopen the work session on House Bill 2100 in that he may be able to cast a vote. Any objections? Hearing none, I will reopen the work session. Representative Ringel, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Representative Ringel votes aye. Close the work session on House Bill 2100.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Is that the only one? The other one's going to Ways and Means, so you shouldn't care. What I was going to announce to the committee is next Wednesday we are taking our committee field trip.